This afternoon to Mincha, we read Kriyas HaTorah. We started Parshas Vayisara. So we read the way Sari Menu passes away, and Avraham Avinu starts to negotiate about purchasing the Maris HaMachpelah. And the Gemara establishes the principle of Kiddushei Kesef, that one can get married by giving a ring, or by giving cash, or by giving a lollipop, whatever, by giving a date, Iskachili B'tam Razul, you give a fruit or something. As long as the thing is a Shavaputta, so the Gemara establishes this principle based on the pasuk by Avraham Avinu. How did Avraham Avinu acquire the Maris HaMachpelah? By paying cash. So too one can acquire a wife by paying money. So the Maskilim throughout all the generations were always making fun of the rabbis of the Talmud, that they treat the relationship between the husband and the wife as if the farmer buys himself a horse, or the man buys himself real estate, and he owns his wife, and he does whatever he wants to the wife. So Rabbi Samson, Raphael Hirsch, addresses this issue, and he points out that when you study Choshen Mishpat, it's very clear that in a situation of marriage, the husband does not own his wife. And the Taz even proves that when you buy real estate and you pay money, the money is not that you're paying the value of the real estate, because how can the rabbis derive Kiddushei Kesef from Avraham Avinu buying real estate? That by the real estate he pays for the value of the karka. And by marriage, either the wife is priceless or worthless, one or the other. But she's not worth the ring that he gives her. The ring is worth $100 or something, so she's not worth the value of the ring. So it can't be that it's kesef kinyan. So the Taz proves that that's given, that by kiddushin is not paying money to buy the wife. It's a maisa kinyan, and what's called is marriage. Ishus is called, not a bailus over it. The Taz demonstrates in this that when you buy karka, the giving of the money is just a symbolic act. It's not that you're paying the value. The karka is worth $1 million and you'll only give a nickel. And you're kind of the whole karka. And it's not that you zoka follow the building. So this is a double pashut, that the husband doesn't own the wife. There's even a dispute, a famous argument between the Pnei Yehoshua, he was the rabbi in Frankfurt, in the 1700s, the Pnei Yehoshua, and the Avne Miluim, the author of the Tzoy Sarchoshin, whether there's what we call a kinyan iser. The Pnei Yehoshua is of the opinion that when a couple gets married, the husband has what we call a kinyan iser on the wife. And the Avne Miluim thinks that that's also not right. Not only does he not have an ownership, a kinyan mom doesn't have a kinyan iser. It's a marriage, it's a relationship. Why did the rabbis choose to learn out Kicha Kicha Mr. Ephron? Why did they choose to establish the principle that Kiddushin can be accomplished through Kesef? By the similarity of the verb that appears by marriage and by purchasing of the Maris HaMachpelah. So Rabbi Hirsch says a beautiful idea. He says, what was Avraham Avinu doing over here? He was spending a fortune of money to be mechabed his wife after she passed away. The Maris says the din is that the husband has to be mechabed his wife while she's alive. So he has to mechabit his wife more than he would insist on covet for himself. He has to be more medactic on the covet for his wife than on his own covet. So the Gemara has a dispute among the Tanaim. What if the wife passed away already? Do you still say he has to go out of his way to be mechabit so much? Let's say in his family they spend fortunes of money on matzavas. And in her family, her parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, they didn't spend so much money on matzavas. They would spend, they would buy a cheap matzeva and donate money to yeshivas in memory of Dinesh. But they wouldn't spend money on the matzeva. So normally the din is, while the husband is married to his wife, let's say, that's learned out, this din that I'm about to explain is learned out from the Pasuk in Terei Sedra, as far as it's Vayera. So the Gemara says the din is the husband is obligated to support his wife. To support his wife on what standard of living? He'll pay her. She should buy one dress every year, right? One dress for the summer, one dress for the winter, and that's all. And two pairs of shoes, one for Shabbos and one for the weekdays, that's all. So the Gemara says if the husband can afford more, he's obligated to give more. But what if in his family, let's say they're both wealthy families, they're both well-to-do, and he's doing well also. It's not a shiloh whether he can't afford. We're talking they can't afford. But let's say in his family, they always used to go all shalosh regalim, and they went to Yerushalayim to the hotel. And every summer they went to Switzerland. And every winter they went to whatever, Mexico. They're always traveling around. And her family, they always stayed home. Okay, so whatever. And his family, they always had maids helping out in the home. And her family, they never did. Not that they couldn't afford it. They could afford it. They just didn't. That was their style. So when they get married, so does the wife, what style of living is the wife entitled to? So the Gemara says, you go the Chumrah in both directions. The husband can't say, I'll treat you the way your father treated your mother. If his father, if her in-laws, if his parents lived on a higher standard of living, he has to treat her, if he can afford it, he has to treat her like that. Or if his parents never spend so much, they never spend so much money, but her parents didn't. The husband can afford it. So the halacha says, Oyla imo, veino yeredes imo. She goes up to the higher, whichever is the higher level, the higher standard of living. The husband is mechuyev to treat her like that. If she's interested, she's not interested in this, but if she's interested in it, then he's mechuyev to treat her like that. So the Gemara has a dispute. What about lachamisa's ishta? What if the wife died, and in his family, they have golden ematzevus. They spend thousands of dollars on a matzeva. And her family, they can afford it. They didn't make any sense. They never did it. And now the wife passed away. So the husband mechuyev to spend a fortune of money on the levaya. They used to have musicians play at funerals. They used to pay money to import maspidim. They used to spend a lot of money at funerals in the days of the Tanaim. Today also, people spend a fortune of money on funerals. So is the husband obligated to spend that fortune of money after the wife dies? Do you say even after she died, they're not married anymore? You still say, the husband is still mechuyev. So that's a dispute, and we pass in yes. So the pasuk says regarding Avraham Avinu that he spent a hoin rav, he spent such a fortune of money to purchase a special plot to bury his wife in a bekavadika fashion. So that's what the rabbis wanted to derive. They could have learned that kicha from some other source also, that it's kidusha kesef is a valid form of creating marriage. The reason why they chose to learn that from Shtei Efron, because the story of the Moras HaMachpelah demonstrates how much Avraham Avinu went out of his way to spend money for his wife. So every Jewish marriage should be not based on wasting money, but every Jewish marriage should be based on such a love between the husband and the wife that the husband should be prepared to spend money for his wife if he's able to. Even lachamisa sishtoy, like Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was so in love with his wife, even after she died, he spent a fortune of money for the kavurim. The Gemara has this principle, oyves ishtoy kigufa machabda yosem igufa. The husband has to love his wife like he loves himself. Kigufa or machabda has to honor the wife yosem igufa. This is based on, there are different psukim in the chumash. There is a pasuk that gives us a mitzvah, v'hafta l'rachav kamoicha. So it doesn't mean we have to love everybody. You have to love all the Jews the same. I have to love my next door neighbor's wife the same way I love my wife. Very not mistabit. So the Gemara understood. That we have to l'rachav kamoicha doesn't mean that all men are created equal. It means you have to love your wife more than you love anybody else. Then you have to love your children more than you love the next door neighbor's children. Then you have to love your relatives, your parents more than you love strangers. It's not that it's bishavet to everybody. How is it possible for a person to control himself? Let's say his wife is not so good looking and the next the neighbor's wife is extremely good looking, so how can he control himself not to fall in love with the next door neighbor's wife? So the Ibn Ezra points out in his commentary on Chumash, as a famous comment, how can the Chumash say lo sachma reishis v'yecha? How can the Torah tell me you're not permitted to desire the next door neighbor's wife? So he says, Pashut, we know that people can control their desires. If something is totally out of my reach, I won't even have a desire for it. He says that the farmer will never develop a desire to marry the king's daughter. It's not shayach. Not shayach in a million years. The king is not going to let him marry his daughter, so he won't even have a desire to marry her in the first place. So the Torah tells us we have to learn to control that. We have the ability to control our emotions. We have to learn to control our emotions. So each person has to have a love for their spouse. The husband has to love his wife more than anyone else. And the wife has to love her husband more than she loves anybody else. Not just that they happen to be living together, but they really have a crush on someone else. That's against the halacha. The halacha says they have to l'rachav kamoicha, and the Gemara has a tradition that it's not that you have to love all Jews to the same extent. The love has to be towards spouses much more than to other people. Then the Chachamim have a pasuk. There is a mitzvah of Kavod Abrius. Kavod Abrius is derived, we must have spoken in the past about this. The Torah says that a Kohen is not permitted to be mitami to any mason, unless it's one of the seven relatives, then he's permitted to be mitami. So the pasuk says, father, mother, child, or if his sister who is never married before, lo yitamo. So the Tanoim had a dispute, how do you translate that phrase, lo yitamo? He's permitted to go to the funeral, or he's obligated to attend the funeral. So the accepted opinion, this was a dispute in the days of the second Beis HaMikdosh and after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdosh. So the psak, the generally accepted psak all along was that lo yitamo is a chovah. It's not a mishus, not that he's permitted to. He's obligated to be mitame, and that is one of the 613 mitzvahs. Lo yitame. That is the mitzvah to show kavod abriyus. Now the kohen is only permitted and obligated to be mitame to one of the seven relatives. To other people, not. So obviously you're not kosher also when you have the mitzvah of kavod abriyus. It's not b'shovet to everybody. There's a din of kibud aviyein. You have to be mechabed parents more than strangers. You have to be mechabed the melech. There's a din of kavod amelech. There's a din of kavod talmid hachachamim. Then there's a din of kavod between the husband and the wife. The husband is mechuyev to be mechabed the wife. The wife is mechuyev to be mechabed the husband. It's not that they're mechuyev to the same extent that they have to be mechabed kavod abriyus in general. Kavod abriyus in general is because we assume that all people were created with tzelem elokim. So you have to be mechabed every human being, Jews and non-Jews, because of the spark of the divine that everyone contains within them. And in fact, the commentaries explain on the psukim in the beginning of this week's Seder, the beginning of Parshas Vayera, that it says the angels appeared to Avraham Avin. He didn't realize they were angels in the beginning, thought they were human beings. And he was in the middle of being mekabel p'nei HaShechina. The Shechina had come to be mevaker HaSachayla, to Avraham Avinu, and he was mafsik in the middle of Kabbalah p'nei HaShechina, in order to be machnes orchin. So the Gemara derives from this parasha that Avraham Avinu did the right thing. G'doylo hachnosos orchin yosem hachbolos p'nei HaShechina. So this is the principle of kavod abriyus. The kavod abriyus is so important, he didn't realize that they were angels sent from God. He thought that these were human beings. So the din requires, in fact, is it permissible to talk in the middle of Kriya Shema? Everybody knows that it's not right. Even the people who talk in the middle of davening, they know that it's not right. Not allowed to talk in the middle of davening. So the Gemara says, a pasuk v'dibart abom. The Gemara says, v'loy betfilo. What does that mean, v'dibart abom, v'loy betfilo? So Rashi has one pshat, and Tosfos learns in Shulchan Aruch, they quote the pshat that Tosfos gives them. Dibart abom means there's a mitzvah to talk in the middle of Kriya Shema, but you're not allowed to talk in the middle of davening Shemon Esrei. Who ever heard of such a mitzvah to talk in the middle of Kriya Shema? So Tosfos explains, no, the Mishnah says in Brachas, I'm in the middle of saying Kriya Shema, and someone comes into shul, and he's going to feel hurt if I don't greet him. He doesn't realize that I'm in the middle of Kriya Shema, you're not allowed to talk. He doesn't know what's going on. Bal Tshuva, whatever. But he doesn't realize I'm saying Kriya Shema. So he's going to feel that I'm angry at him if I don't say hello. Or if he greets me, he says, good morning, good Shabbos. So I have to respond. So the Tanoim understood from the pasuk that Dibart Abam, if there's an issue of Kavod Abriyus involved, so then you're permitted and obligated to be mafsik in the middle of Kriya Shema. I Kriya Shema is Kabbalah Samach Hashemayim, speaking about the important things, Varm Ham, the Merumah Shalayim, Kabbalah Sal Mitzvahs, and so on. Still, the Dibart Abam. In the middle of Shema Nesri, not. If someone talks to me in the middle of Shema Nesri, even if he's going to feel hurt, I'm not allowed to be mafsik. There's a limit. But in the middle of Kriya Shema, so the Gemara learns up in the pasuk, the Dibart Abam, that's the same as this principle, that Kavod Abriyus is Gedolah Hachnosos Sarchem Yosem Hakbolos Pnei Hashchina. The Rav Hamavino is mafsik in the middle of the Kabbalos Pnei Hashchina to greet the strangers. He thought that they were human beings. In fact, that's what Rav Soloveitchik said over the Darshanim in Europe used to say. Why did the Rabbanu Shalom send the Malachim in the middle while he was there? The Shechina should have come bin Mevaka the Chayla, and after the Shechina would go away, then he would send the Malachim. No, that was a test to see if Avraham Avinu would do the right thing. Will Avraham Avinu know that you're supposed to be mafsik in the middle of Kabbalah's Pinashkina to greet the guest at a Kavod Abriyus or not? And he passed the test. He was mafsik in the middle of the Kabbalah's Pinashkina to be mechabed the Orchim. So we have a principle of Kavod Abriyus. Kavod Abriyus is one of the 613 mitzvahs, and it's based on the pasuk of Lo Yitamo. That pasuk happens to be talking about Kavod Amesim. But the Gemara understands that it's a Kavod Chaymer. We don't give more kavod to the dead than we give to the living. The Gemara understands that kavod achaim is certainly more severe than kavod amesim, much more humble than kavod amesim. So based on that pasuk that says lo yitamo, so the Gemara establishes a whole sugya in brachas, establishes the principle of the mitzvah of kavod abriyus to be mechabed people even after they die, kavod achaim while they're still alive. So again, the Gemara understands that the chi of kavod is not b'shovet to everybody. There's a chiyuv kibud aviyein, which is more than to other people, a chiyuv kavod talmid hachachamim, kavod amelech, and so on. So there's a chiyuv of kavod, the husband has to be mechabed the wife, and the wife has to be mechabed her husband to a greater extent than one is expected to be mechabed other people. In the psukim, it's unclear, but that's a lachachamim lo misarakos v'al lachachamim. The chachamim determine, they establish that there are gradations, there are different gradations.
Derive from that even in the middle of Shemayna Esrei, one could be able to
good question, but the Gemara says not so. The Gemara considers that like Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema is also Kabbalah's Pnei Hashchina in a certain sense. But we draw a line and we say no. Shema Nesrei not, then Kriya Shema yes. The kovid that's due to one spouse, that the Gemara says the husband has to be mechabed the wife and the wife has to be mechabed the husband, this is not really an absolute allegiance. The only absolute allegiance that the Jew has is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's say a couple are married and the husband decides he's going to become a crook. So the wife has to support him in his endeavors. Or the wife decides she doesn't want to keep kashrus anymore. Or she doesn't want to keep taras hamishpacha anymore. So the husband has to go along. He has allegiance to his wife, he has to be mechabed the wife. So we assume that that's certainly not correct. Whenever there's any allegiance to any boss of Adam that comes in, let's say, covered kibbutz aviyei, and my father wants me to drive him to the park on Shabbos. So it's prohibited, you're not allowed to. Even if the father asks me to violate an isa derabbanan, and it says in Shulchan Aruch, even if he requests me to violate a minhog, you're not permitted. There's no mitzvah of kibbutz aviyei, there's no mitzvah of covered. Of covered abrius to show the allegiance or obligations to be obedient to any human being, if it's in contradiction to any of the mitzvahs hatar, even if it's a minik, unless it's a minik that not everybody observes. Okay, so let's say bahab, that some people fast on sheni b'chamishi b'sheni after sukkahs, and many people don't fast today. Hardly anybody fasts. So if my father asks me, and let's say I was interested in fasting bahab. And my father asks me, he'd like me to come visit him to eat with him dinner. So I say, I'll come visit you, but I'm not going to eat dinner. My father wants me to eat with him. He doesn't want me to come and sit there and listen while he's eating and carry on conversation. He feels uncomfortable, wants me to eat. So it says, if it's something like Bahab, that's a minig that some people do, but it's not a widespread minig, so then the covered kibbutz aviyei takes precedence over that minig, a personal minig that I have. But if it's a widespread minig, that's a common minig that everybody observes, so there's no din of kibbutz aviyei, there's no din of kovod abal, there's no din of kovod ishtoi, all of these, any allegiance that's to any boss of Adam, it cannot be an absolute allegiance. The only absolute allegiance we have is towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Years ago, during the McCarthy era, there was a pilpul about this. McCarthy was looking for all the communists, so the shaila is, if I know that my spouse is spying for Russia, so am I supposed to maser on my spouse? And he say, no, have a shibud to your spouse. So there was a whole pilpul in the United States, whether the shibud, whether the allegiance to the country takes precedence over the allegiance to the spouse, or the allegiance to the spouse takes precedence to the allegiance to the country. But by us, we assume the allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If the spouse decides they want to stop observing Taras HaMishpacha, Shabbos, or Kashrus or something, so you cannot say the spouse has a Shubit to go along. You're Meshubit, each one is Mechiv to me, Mechabit the other one to support the other one. It doesn't apply in such a case. When the person wants to violate the laws of the Torah, it doesn't apply. In fact, the Chavis Alvavis has a comment that the Pasuk says in the Kriya Shema that we recite every day, B'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, that the love HaKadosh Baruch Hu with all of your heart. So if you use all of your heart to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is there any room to love your spouse or to love your parents or to love your children? There's no room to love anybody else. If you're supposed to express all of the chol of avka, your whole entire heart's made as he has to be poured out to express a love towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Chavis HaLvavis says that that's part of the love towards God. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to marry and to have children and to lead normal lives, and he wants us to love our wives. So loving our spouses and loving our children and loving our parents is part of our expression of our love towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what he wants us to do. He wants us to lead normal lives. But if the love towards the spouse or towards the parents is going to lead one to violate the love towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it's already a separate love. So there is no independent allegiance to a boss of Adam. The only absolute allegiance that we have is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rav Soloveitchik gave one of the drushes they used to give, a drush every year at the Mizrahi Convention. So some of them are printed. So one of the drushes, I'm pretty sure that this one is in print, one of the drushes, he was speaking about the fact that many of the religious Jews feel such an allegiance towards Medina Yisrael, that whatever the Medina does is okay. and they do Chilul Shabbos, and they give treifas, and whatever they do, and they shmar up people, and they cut off the payas from the Sephardim, or come to ourselves, whatever, they put them on anti-religious kibbutzim, whatever they do, whatever is necessary for the Medina, they have such an allegiance to the Medina, whatever they do is okay. So Rav Soloveitchik said, that's Avodah Zarah. Allegiance to some independent, an absolute allegiance to something other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu is what we call Avodah Zarah. That's commonly known as Avodah Zarah. The only absolute allegiance we have is towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have an allegiance to family and to Medina and so on as part of that, like the Chavis HaLvavah says, that's part of our expression of love towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's not something independent. So the same is by family. There is no absolute allegiance to a spouse or to anything like that. It's supposed to be part of our expression of love towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What exactly does it mean Mechabda Yosef Migufa, that the husband has to be Mechabda his wife more than himself? So, okay, it means he has to hold the door for his wife, he has to help her put on a coat. Okay, that's part of it. But that's not the whole thing. The main part of Mechabda Yosef Migufa goes in money. That's how the Gemara says. It goes with respect to spending money. It means if the husband has $200 to spend, that he doesn't need for running the household, and either the wife will buy a new dress or the husband will buy a new suit, and he's scholarshing to get a new suit and she's scholarshing to get a new dress, and they only have $200 and they can't split it in half. So the din is mechabda yosef migufa. The wife takes the kedima. He has to spend the money on his wife. Unless the wife has 35 dresses in the closet and he only has one suit. Or let's say the wife wants a fancy dress and he mamash has, he's walking with torn shoes. Okay, if that's what she wants, then Ritzon Shalom Adam Zel Kvodo, that's the covet. But if it's a toss up between the husband wants to spend some money and it's approximately equal, the husband has a need and the wife has a need, it's approximately equal, and there's only enough money for one, so that's what the Gemara says. Mechabda Yosef Migufa, the husband has shibudim to spend money on the wife. It's the psukim and chumash, shared ksusim and also lo yigra. Mechuyev to support his wife. So to support his wife doesn't only mean one dress for the summer, one dress for the winter. If he can afford more, he's mechuyev to give more. And if, as we mentioned before, if his family, his father used to spend more on his mother than her family, her father spent on her mother. So you go lechumra in both directions if the husband can afford it. The Chafetz Chaim, in several of his essays, complains about the fact Chafetz Chaim lived in Poland at a time that most of the Jews were so poor they couldn't afford anything. So he complains about the fact that very often the husbands didn't have a chance to learn because the wives would tax the husbands. They would want another dress and another pair of shoes and another pocketbook, so the husband had to get another job in order to work in the daytime and night, and he didn't have any free time to learn Torah. So he says that that's not right, that the wife should tax the husband. We're not talking about the taxing the husband. We're talking, in America, most people do make a living. But sometimes there's an issue, should I spend this little extra money on myself or should I spend it on the spouse? So then the Gemara understands, Mechabda Yosef Migufoy. And Rabbi tells his students, all the Hasidic Rebbes used to tell this to their Talmidim. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says that Rabbi told the students, based on a pasuk in today's Sedra, Ul Avram Heitiv Bavura. So the Rabbi told the students, Akiru Nishaihu, you should be Mechabed your wife, spend money on them, Kehechet the Tisasra, that's a Zgula for Ashiras. If you spend money within reason, not that he's going to spend, blow in all of his money, doesn't know where he's going to get the next paycheck from. No, the person knows he makes a decent living, he knows he has the money to spend on his wife. So the Halacha says that he's supposed to Mechabed Yosef Migufa, he has to spend the money on his wife, and spending money on one's wife is supposed to be a Zgula for Ashiras based on a pasuk in today's Sedra. It says, Uli Avram Heitiv Bavuro. The Gemara says that because of the principle of the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamoicha, that it doesn't apply equally to all people, that the spouses are supposed to have more of a love towards each other than to love the next door neighbor's wife. So that's why the Gemara says that you should be careful. Before you get married, make sure that you know each other sufficiently that you will be able to love them. So the Gemara says, from the perspective of the boy, that he's not allowed. He's not allowed to propose to a girl to get married until he sees who she is first. He spends a little time with her. Years ago, there was a famous maisa that there were so many divorces going on in New York. All of now is worse. every other person is getting divorced. So they interviewed Rav Moshe Bick. Moshe Bick was busy doing so many gittin for his balabatim. So he was quoted in the Yiddish newspaper used to come out every day then. So they had to find things to write about every day. There isn't so much news to write in the Yiddish newspaper. That comes out once a week and they don't have so much to write in the once a week newspaper. So they interviewed Rav Moshe Bick. So he said he thinks the problem is that the boys don't go out with the girls enough times before they get married, before they get engaged. They have to go out a minimum of 8 dates. If they don't go out 8 dates, they're not allowed to get engaged. And that's based on the Gemara. Gemara says, Achirena Tchili has to see her, and he said 8 days. At that time, the Satmar Rebbe was told, the previous Satmar Rebbe, I don't know if he read the Yiddish newspaper, someone told him what Rav Moshe Bick said. So he was not happy with that idea. He didn't think it was such a smart idea. She got an 8 days. So he said, "Oy, this bothers him." The pasuk says, "Katzi b'chayim epnei benois cheis." Benois cheis, the 8 dates. The boys who take 8 dates with the girl before they get engaged, that's what he called katzi b'chayim epnei benois cheis. But still, the ma'aseh, Rabbi Bick, with all due respect, Rabbi Bick is right. You're going to get engaged before you really know the girl. So you're not going to really love the girl. And the Gemara says from the perspective of the girl also. The Gemara says it's not permissible for a father, for a parent, to ram a shidduch down their daughter's throat until she's old enough. You're not allowed to marry off a young girl until she's old enough. I should tigdal the term of beploni ani rotz, until she agrees. She has to meet the guy and see what he's like and agree. Taisva says that for years they were in violation of this law. They used to marry off the children when they were young because they lived in such difficult times. They hardly made any parnosa. So if now you have a little money to marry off your child, you don't know what's going to be in another 3 years. And they had the crusade were going on. The father may be killed if he's going to wait another year. We're killing Jews all over the place. So the Balei HaTosfos say that unfortunately they gripe with the krechts. Unfortunately we have no choice. We violate this din. But if you live in a normal society, you're not supposed to violate the din. The boy shouldn't go blindfolded to the chuppah. And nor should the girl go blindfolded to the chuppah. Both of them have to meet and have to get to know the other person. In order to, the Gemara says, in order that they shouldn't be in violation of the mitzvah, we have to the racha kamarka, because the Tanaim understood that spouses have to have much more of a love towards each other than towards the next door neighbor's spouse. That's what they understood was a davar pashut.
What's the part that she has to be in?
The Gemara says, that also. Same daf where it says the book. But still, the Gemara says, "Asalam shekadosh is bitek tana ach tigdal b'taima b'ploni ani reitzah." The Gemara says like that. Despite the fact that one might argue, perhaps, and think tabla meisa tandu, nonetheless, the Gemara says that's the din. We're concerned that that she may not love him later on. She wants
something
and saving money. In each case, you got to do whatever is reasonable, because there are always contradictions. Take Lamashal. There is a din of Kibbut Aviyim. Now, the din of Kibbut Aviyim, even though the Chumash only says Kabeira Savicha Vesimecha, my father and my mother, but the word S. In Shulchan Aruch, they say the word S always comes to be marbe, to add on something else. It says kabeit es avicha. The es imecha comes to include the in-laws, the parents-in-law. The one is obligated to be mechabed the in-laws. And the husband is obligated to be mechabed the wife, and the wife is mechiv to be mechabed the husband. So sometimes you'll have a... And then the Gemara says that the wife's obligation to be mechabed the husband takes precedence over her obligation to be mechabed her parents. Yeah, but the husband has an obligation to be mechabed the in-law. So what do you mean? Why does the wife's obligation to be mechabed the husband take precedence over the wife's obligation to be mechabed? Let's say, for example, let's say the couple lives in New York, and the husband has little babies, so the wife is taking care of the children, and her mother doesn't feel well, and you know, her mother's in California. So she wants to fly off. She says, "Goodbye, darling, I'm taking the flight, and I'm going to California to help back my mother." So the husband says, "What do you mean? But I need you over here. You have to take care of the children." So she said, "You figure it out. Get some babysitting." So the din is that she's not allowed to do this. Yes, but if the mother-in-law is really sick and she really needs help, then the husband is mechuyev to go tell. So isn't it a contradiction? So the answer is, you have to ask a third party who will determine what's reasonable. You always have conflicts in life. You know? In marriage, you always have conflicts on the one hand and on the other hand and on the other hand. There's more than two hands. So you have all the hands put together, so you always ask what's the most reasonable under the circumstances, and that's the Chiyuv Kavod that takes precedence. In the days of the Rishonim, there was an interesting dispute regarding the mitzvah in Chumash, the obligation that the husband has to support his wife. He has to spend money to buy her food and clothing. What exactly does that mean? What if the husband is unemployed? He sits in the Beis Medrash and he learns. And they give one shul, they give a free breakfast. So he comes over there, eats a free breakfast there. Then there's a bar mitzvah over there, so he eats by this bar mitzvah. Monday and Thursday he fasts. He has no problem. He Shabbos there's a kiddush and a shalach and a shabbos. But he doesn't support his wife. So what does the obligation mean? That you, if you earn money, you have to give over part of that money to your wife for food and clothing? Or does it mean you're obligated to take a job in order to be able to give your wife food and clothing? So Taisus in Ksubis quotes that this was a big dispute among the Baliyah Taisus. And then they say that we can't say this too loud. This will be an embarrassment to the Jewish people, that the husband is not obligated to take a job. That's ridiculous, Taisus. That's ridiculous. But there was a minority opinion like that. The husband is not obligated to take a job. If he earns money, he's obligated to hand over so much money to the wife that she needs for food and clothing, but it's not mechuyav to get a job. So in the Sefer Nachla Shiva is a classic Sefer that was written a few centuries ago that basically discusses the text of the Ksuba. He goes every word in the Ksuba, why you spell it like this and what it means and what the background is. So he writes on the way we write a Ksuba. So it says in the text of the obligation there, Ano Eflach, I obligate myself to get a job to support my wife. So he says the reason why we write that is because there was a minority opinion that the husband is not obligated to get a job. Only if he earns money, he has to hand over the money to the wife. But if he's not earning anything and he has no savings, he's not mechuyav to support the wife. So even if the din were so, but if we write in the ksuba that we're obligating ourselves, so we're mechuyav to go get the job. So the Maisa said that's, we all write that in the ksuba, and even if he wouldn't write in the ksuba, the accepted opinion of the husband is obligated to get a job. We live in different times. By us it's very common a boy gets married in college, right after college, and he has another 5 years to law school or whatever, to medical school. He's going to become a psychiatrist. More than 5 years, a long haul to go. So it's understood that in our circumstances, sometimes the husband doesn't always get a job. Right, the wife is going to say, I want you to get a job. So he'll say, no, but when we were going out on dates, you knew that I wasn't... You knew that I planned to go to graduate school. You know I wasn't going to be earning money the next couple of years. So the wife can't have a taina to the husband. I want you to go get a job and scrap your plans about going to medical school or graduate school or whatever. So the same is true regarding koilo. It's abnormal. The normal thing is that the husband is mechuyav to earn money and to support his wife. We live in an abnormal world. The mon doesn't fall down from heaven. So people have to go to graduate school to prepare for medicine or for law or for whatever graduate work they're going to do. So people are going to go into the rabbinate or even not go into the rabbinate. Some people just want to learn a couple of years. So if it was understood that the husband is going to learn for a couple of years, within reason, not the first 50 years of marriage, for a couple of years, within reason, so then the husband won't be considered in violation of his obligations of Ano Eflam, that he signed the Ksuba, I will take a job and I will support you. Within reason, everything has to be within reason. So that's the obligation of share ksus. The husband has an obligation to support the wife to the best of his ability, depending on how much money he earns, to the higher standard of living, considering the two families. The obligation of ona means marital relations. And this is sometimes the cause of friction in marriage. There is an obligation. The husband is meshuvah to the wife, and the wife is equally meshuvah to the husband, within reason. So the Talmud explains what's considered within reason. So it depends on how difficult the husband works for a living. If he knocks his kishkes out and is so exhausted every day, so he can't expect that much of the husband to spend that much time with his wife. So the Talmud has a lot of details about this, how much ona one is obligated how much, to what extent is one obligated to give the marital relation. So in the Shulchan Aruch they point out, let's say the husband decides he, whenever there's a shalom hilchas nida, he wants to be machmer. What do you mean machmer? Machmer means on the wife's expense. The wife is not interested in being machmer. She wants to lead a normal life. She wants to be tahorim and teres lebayla. He's always looking for chumras. Or the husband's always running, oh, someone's saying a shiur in Teaneck tonight. And someone's saying a shiur in Woodmere tomorrow night. Someone's saying a shiur in Connecticut tomorrow night. You're running around to shiur, and the wife has no courage to stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning. The husband's going to come back. So he always comes home, she's always sleeping. So that's not right. So it has to be within reason. The husband is not permitted to volunteer to lead a life of midas chasidus because he's cheating his wife. That's what the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch quote, the story in the Gemara. There was a big dispute in the days of the Tanoim. The chief rabbi was Rabbi Gamliel, and he was a little too tough, so they fired him. They fired the chief rabbi. And they were trying to determine whom should they appoint in his stead. So they finally decided, can't appoint Rabbi Kiva, he doesn't have enough yichas, can't appoint Rabbi Shua, that'll be too much of an insult to Rabbi Gamliel, because they fired him because he was abusive of Rabbi Yeshua. Can't appoint this one, can't appoint that one. They finally decided they're going to appoint Rabbi Lozim and Azai. Lozim and Azai was a very young man. Mar says he was 18 years old, 17, 18 is very young. So Rabbi Lozim and Azai says, I have to consult my wife. What was his wife was the brains. Maybe the wife was smarter than him. Maybe she had a better chush for politics. So the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Haflo and not Gemara, no. If he's going to be appointed chief rabbi, he's going to have to fly off to represent the chief rabbi of Israel. He has to go attend every function, every night. There's been another function. He has to go away. Yom Tov, Shabbos, he's always away. Alaska, Philippines, South America, South Africa. He never has a normal home life. So he understood Rabbi Lozim Azariah was a normal rabbi. If they're going to make him chief rabbi, he's hardly going to be with his wife. So he felt the halacha requires, he has to get permission from his wife. The halacha says, a husband in Shulchan Aruch says, the husband is not allowed to change his profession if the new profession that he wants to change to will mean that he's going to be so much more busy with his work that he's going to have less time to spend with his wife. He has to get the permission from the wife. So even to take on a very Torahic position like to become the chief rabbi, even a holy position and learning all Torah, you're not allowed to take such a position without the approval of the wife. My father told me that he remembered when he was a child in Europe, in Cheder, and the Lamed was teaching Chumash, so they had to translate into Yiddish for little children. So how do you translate marital relations in Yiddish? Sherei ksusa v'yonasa. So ksusa means the husband has to buy clothing for the wife, and Sherei has to give her food. Sherei is food, and ksusa is clothing. How do you translate onasa? So my father said he remembers the Malamed had getaich sight. The word ona means time, that the husband has to spend time with his wife. The truth of the matter is that that's the correct translation. That is not incorrect. The word ona means marital relation, but it also means time. The Gemara says even when the wife is not able to go to the mikveh, still it's not proper for someone to barge in on their privacy. The husband and the wife have to have privacy even when she's in need. They want to talk together. They want to spend time together. The Gemara says it's not right that someone should decide they want to sleep in their bedroom. To have a bar mitzvah or whatever, and the husband can't be with his wife anyway because she's not tahora. So some other guests want to sleep in their bedroom, or they want to keep them up all night long. So the Gemara says in Erev, and that's not proper, it's not permissible. Even though she's in need anyway, the husband has to spend time with his wife, not to talk about lovey-dovey things if she can't go to the mitzvah, but to spend time with his wife. That's part of the obligation of ona. It's talking not an incorrect translation. Ona taka means tzait, to spend time with the wife. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, "Al tar b'sichim ha'isha, b'ishto yomer kal v'chomer v'eshes chavera." So on that Mishnah, the one is not permitted to spend tar b'sichim, not permitted to spend too much time speaking with his wife, meaning yakking for hours and hours. But it doesn't mean the husband shouldn't spend any time at all with his wife. Has to be within reason, a little time. Has to be within reason. There is a dispute in the commentaries on the Mishnah. Al tar b'sichem ha'isha, whether it only refers to ishtoi nida, ishtoi ma kavacham beishes chaver, just like eishes chaver is prohibited to me, so ishtoi nida is also prohibited. But it goes on ishtoi nida, doesn't go on his wife when she's tahor. Or no, perhaps it even goes on regular ishtoi. But even however you read pshat in the Mishnah, It doesn't mean to say that a husband is not allowed to spend any time speaking privately with his wife when she's a nida. That's not true. The Gemara says explicitly he's obligated to spend time with his wife. He's obligated to spend more time speaking with his wife when she's tahara, and to speak a little more in a more friendlier fashion than when she's tameya. But he's obligated to spend time in both cases. My father was father's retired now, he's over 90, but for many years he used to deal in gittin. So he always would tell the students in yeshiva that the overwhelming majority of the gittin are due to either money disputes between the spouses or in-law trouble. So the money disputes, often the source would be that the husband doesn't realize that he has an obligation to spend money on his wife. These are clear-cut halachas in the Gemara. Remember, there was a couple who came to us, not from our yeshiva. A couple came to us, the husband would give away every penny to the shul. He didn't have a penny of savings. He gave away all of his money to the shul. Why? That's what his parents told him. He has to give all the money away to the shul. So this was ruining their marriage. It's ridiculous. He's not allowed to. The Allah says you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to give away all of your money to Shul. So, we finally convinced them that it's against the din, and now they're still married, happily married. They got along together. Money is often a major source of trouble. And the in-law trouble is also, the Mishnah says whenever a couple gets divorced, the husband is obligated to pay ksuba, even if it's not his fault. Even if no one was at fault, it's just they got bored of each other. They fell out of love. So the halacha says the husband has to take ksuba. Unless you can really determine, you can establish that it was the fault of the wife who ruined the marriage. So how do you determine that the wife is at fault for ruining the marriage? The wife decides she doesn't want to go to mikveh anymore. Okay, so she's ruining the marriage. The wife decides she doesn't want to have any children, period. If they have already 10 children, she doesn't want to have any more children. I might agree with them. Okay. They have no children. They have no children. She doesn't want to have any children, period. So that's it's understood. When people get married, they're going to have children. So the Mishnah has, if the wife refuses to have children. So that's a cause for divorce. Or the Mishnah has a case, Mikaleles Yoldov Bifono. The wife is cursing the in-laws. She's extremely disrespectful of the in-laws in the presence of the husband. To us, Kibud Av is a very important mitzvah. The family unit is very important to the Jewish people. The whole Jewish people is considered one big family. Even the gerim, even the converts, when they daven Shmoneh Esrei, when they say Elokeinu Elokei Avoseinu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yankiv, everybody, all the Jewish people, even those who are not biological descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yankiv, refer to them as our forefathers. And we treat the whole Jewish people as one big family. In Chumash, there are many dinim about Achicha. And it doesn't refer to my brother. Achich means achicha b'mitzvahs. The co-religionists are all called achicha. Everybody, in a certain sense, everybody is one big family. And in order to maintain this sense of family, so the Torah requires that we have to show kibud av. We have to show respect for the parents. And the respect is obligatory even towards the in-laws. One is not permitted to call his father-in-law by his first name, just like you're not allowed to call your parents by their first name. It's not proper. There's a din of COVID. So one has to be careful. If one will be mezalzel, the husband or the wife will be mezalzel in the COVID of the in-law. See, the husband, it doesn't matter. What the Mishnah only talks about the wife. The kalel is the other one. The husband always pays ksuba, even if no one's fault. They just got bored of each other. Whenever a couple gets divorced, the husband has to pay ksuba. The Mishnah only has to say the exception to the rule. The rule of the husband always pays ksuba. In the event that you can determine that the wife was at fault for ruining the marriage, in that rare case, then we penalize her and she forfeits the tzuba. But that's when the Mishnah only talks from that perspective. If the wife is disrespectful towards her in-laws, then it's considered that she's ruining the marriage, because kibud av v'im is crucial to a marriage. Yeah, the whole marriage represents the concept of family, and kibud av is what holds the whole family together. Now, on the other hand, the parents have to be careful not to, even by children who are not married, when the children are married, the parents have to be careful not to stick in their two cents and give too much guidance to the children. I remember once Rabbi Soloveitchik used to tell all kinds of humorous stories in the middle of class. On one occasion he told us that there was a couple who came to him and they were ready to get divorced, and he realized that the whole source of the problem was that the boy's mother was giving too much advice. So he called her up on the phone and he said she should please, he'd like to speak to her. So she came to him and she spoke Yiddish. She was explaining to her that the truth is a din of kibud av, but the parents are not allowed to give their advice to the children. And he says, I would recommend is altnish geben ken eitzis to the kinder. She shouldn't give any advice. She shouldn't give any eitzis. So she said to him, Rabbi Soloveitchik, where git an eitzis? Give not advice. Yeah, advice. That's exactly. The parents have to realize that even when it's not in the context of a marriage and the in-laws giving advice to a married child or to a married child-in-law, even when the children are single, the parents have to realize that there's a limit to kibud aviyem. Kibud aviyem, we must have discussed it. Kibud aviyem means to service the parents, to do things to be mahana the parents, to give pleasure to the parents. The Gemara gives the example that the parents are old and they need physical assistance walking, and they need help to feed them and to dress them and to bathe them. If it reaches that point, so that's included in kibud aviyem. If the parents are healthy, they should all be healthy. You shouldn't need the physical help. You should need the physical assistance to help them walk and so on. My father's over 90, he would be highly insulted if I say, Dad, you want me to tie your shoelaces? What do you mean? I can tie my own shoelaces. I can make my own cup of coffee. I don't need you to help me make my cup of coffee. But my father wants me to call on the telephone every so often. I should come visit him within reason. I can't visit him every single day. He lives in Brooklyn, I'm living in Manhattan. But it's understood from time to time you have to call, you have to visit to be mahana. That's the yikir mitzvah, kibud aviyem, is to be mahana. Years ago, when they lived in different parts of Europe, so to send letters, if it was prohibitive to call on the telephone, they couldn't afford to call on the telephone, so to send letters is kibud aviyem. So kibud means to be mahana the parents to a reasonable extent, and mora means to have respect for the parents, not to contradict them, to stand up when they come into the room, and so on, to give them what we would call kavod. That's what the Chumash calls mora. Mora aviyem. Kibud aviyem means to give service, to be mahana the parents. Strictly speaking, most of the poskim in Shulchan Aruch say that to be obedient. My father tells me, I want you to become a doctor, I want you to become a lawyer, I want you to move over here, I want you to marry this girl. So strictly speaking, that's not included in kibud aviyem. It's not included in mora. It has nothing to do with kibud, nothing to do with mora. So it's, even by single children, it's not included in kibud and mora. Certainly by married children. So it's not right that the parents-in-law are giving advice to the married children, and they have to refrain from that. Not permissible. Just like the kibud aviyem dictates that it's not permissible to call one's own parents by their first name, even if they want it, it's not proper. So the same is true regarding the in-laws. One is not permitted to call the in-laws by the first name, and not allowed to call them Mrs. Schwartz either. You got to say Mom. If they're still insulted. When I first got married, I used to call my mother-in-law Rebbetzin Shapiro. So she felt very insulted. I'm not Rebbetzin. I'm your mother. I'm going to call a shviger, she'll also feel insulted. you got to say something. Mom, or something. That's in a bekovedige fashion, in a loving fashion, you have to speak. If you have a joint bank account, there's one allowed to veto the other's expenses. It has to be within reason. Everything has to be within reason. We'll get to it. There is a din in Chumash that applies to everybody. The Pasuk has written twice in the end of Chumash Vayikra, Lo sonu ishes amisa. So the Pashup Shatan I know means that you're not allowed to cheat someone by overpricing, by charging too much or by paying too little. I'm buying a used car and the fellow doesn't know how much it's worth, and I'm going to fool him. I'm going to today him a cup, and I'm going to tell him it's only worth $250 and it's worth $2,500. So that's I know. Well, he's going to sell me something and he's going to charge me more than it's worth. So the Gemara is wondering, why does it say twice, one pasuk next to the other, Lasanu Ishi Samisa? What is added by the second pasuk? The Gemara says, no, the second pasuk refers to I know as Dvarim. You're not allowed to cause aggravation to anybody else. You're not allowed to play a practical joke on someone else or something like that that will cause aggravation. Or included is you're not allowed to insult someone. You call them you galitziana. That's a derogatory term. Or you yekim. Or you balchuve. Or you whatever. You call someone skor masecha harishonim. Remember your past. You used to be this and now you're this. You're not allowed to hurt someone's feelings. So these laws, I'm not hurting someone's feelings, apply to all people, including spouses. Somehow people think that's like ishta kegufay and bal ki ishtay. So just like the laws only apply not to hurt someone else's feelings, but there's no law that I shouldn't hurt my own feelings. So one considers oneself with their spouse as one and the same being, so there's no prohibition. So this is not correct. And the Gemara says that it's no chomor if a person hurts the feelings of their spouse, whether the husband hurts the wife's feelings or the wife hurts the husband's feelings. Not only is there the general prohibition of Ainoa's Dvarim that applies to anybody, it's an additional violation over here of the covet. The husband is Mukhid Bikvoid Ishta, the wife is Mukhid Bikvoid Baila. So if a person causes aggravation to their spouse, that's a double violation. A person will be abusive to one spouse by hitting. By some nationalities, the minhag is that the wife beat up the husband. And by other nationalities, the minhag is that the husband beat up the wife. Different nationalities have different minhag. So you're not permitted to harm anyone. You're not permitted to hurt anyone. There's a prohibition in the Torah. Lo yaseh pen yaseh, you're not allowed to harm anyone. You're not allowed to harm yourself either. You're not allowed to harm my own body. So certainly one is not permitted to harm his spouse. If one harms the spouse, in addition to the general violation of chayvo b'chaveiro, there's an additional violation of the mitzvah to be mechabed each other. The husband has to be mechabed the wife has to be mechabed the husband. In the Shulchan Aruch, they quote the cherem hakadmonim shalo lahakos es ishto. So you get the mistaken impression as if until the days of the Gaonim, it was permissible, maybe it was even a mitzvah to beat up your spouse, for the husband to beat up his wife. All of a sudden, the kadmonim, the Gaonim came up with a new original chiddush, a cherem that you're not allowed to beat up your wife. So the truth of the matter is that that's not the pshat. A cherem, when they have a shulchan aruch haramim, it doesn't mean that until then something was permissible, and that from that time on it became prohibited. Take for example, there's a cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon. There are a lot of around 25 haramim Rabbeinu Gershon. One of the more famous ones is a cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon that you're not allowed to read someone else's mail. Do you think for a minute that minatara is permissible to read someone else's mail? It's a biblical prohibition. You don't have to come on to a cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon who lived after the days of the Talmud, after the days of the Gaonim. It's a biblical prohibition. Ignore the rights of Sukkim that each person is entitled to his privacy. You're not permitted to pry into anyone else's privacy. So it's an Issa Daraisa. But the Rabbeinu Gershon saw that too many people were violating this Issa. So he said, whoever, if a person doesn't deserve, a chere means a curse that someone should drop dead. When they put a person in a chere, it means a klala. The Bezin is giving the person a curse that he should die. And when that person dies who was put in cherem, the children don't observe avelos. Like the Mishnah says, harugi bezin. If the bezin gives someone the death penalty, skilu sveta, herik, fenik, whatever, so the Mishnah says that the children don't observe, the relatives don't observe avelos. Vavod Rishon Rina was supposed to celebrate. So if someone was put in cherem by the bezin, so when he dies, even if he doesn't die till another 25 years, he dies at the age of 100. Even it doesn't seem that he died because of the cherem. We consider him like one who died because of the bezin, as if their curse accomplished that he should die. And it says in Shulchan Aruch, the children don't observe avodah. So the Rabbeinu Gershon added on, in certain instances where there was a biblical prohibition anyway, so he added on, you're not allowed to eat someone else's meal, but you don't deserve to be killed. You don't deserve the death penalty. And the children shouldn't observe any avodah at all after the person dies. So the Rabbeinu Gershon said, no, I put in cherem anyone who eats someone else's meal, in order to strengthen this prohibition, in order to strengthen the biblical prohibition. Or the Beis Yosef quotes that there are Rishonim who hold the Tshuvas Aran hold, same is true regarding Shalom Lagarish Ishta Bal Korcha. The Rabbeinu Gershon made a cherem, you're not allowed to divorce your wife against her wishes. You mean, Minatara, it's permissible. A guy's allowed to, he promises the girl he marries her when she's young and beautiful, and then they have all these children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and then he decides he wants to marry this young chick. He gives his wife a get to goodbye and good luck, and he marries his secretary. That's Mutam and Atara. He's allowed to divorce his wife. And she's screaming, bloody murder, what do you mean? I raised all of the children and all the grandchildren, and I worked, so I had to put you through graduate school, and it's because of me that he had. Of course he has no right to divorce his wife. It's an Avera bin Adam HaHavera. You don't need a cherem that Rabbeinu Gershon to prohibit it. The Ram says it's an Issam and Atara. There's a Gemara like that. Sounds like it's an Issam and Atara. Rabbeinu Gershom felt that it's such a terrible thing to do, he added on a cherem. The person doesn't deserve to be killed. He doesn't deserve the death penalty because he divorces his wife against her wishes. So Rabbeinu Gershom added on, no, we put him in cherem. We give him a curse that he should drop dead. So the same is true over here. It's not that until the days of the Gaonim it was permissible for one to beat up his spouse. It's a biblical prohibition. It's a part of the Chumash. You're not allowed to harm anyone physically or to be abusive verbally. It's a din of Einoz Dvar. But the Kanmonim added on a Cherim, a Klola, that whoever does it should be cursed. Part of the din of Kavod requires that a person should not be too dictatorial when speaking to their spouse. For example, the Gemara has a din of Kibbut Aviyim. So let's say the parents send their children to the yeshiva and the children learn in the yeshiva. You're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that, you're not allowed to do the other thing, and they come back and the parents do all these things. So the child tells the father, yeah, Machal Shabbos, you're not allowed to do that. So the Gemara says, you're not allowed to say to your father, yeah, Machal Shabbos, that's traitor. You're not allowed to eat that. You have to say it in a respectful fashion. I think there's a question. You've got to look it up. You have to say it in a Lashon Shel Kavod. So the same is certainly true regarding married couples. But there's a din. Each one is mechuyev to be mechaber the other one. You're not allowed to say with certainty, this is absolutely the way it has to be. The only correct way is the way I say. I remember many years ago I was invited to speak at a Nefesh conference. Nefesh is an organization for psychologists and social workers and people to deal with others to help their problem. So they always have Rabbanim who attend their conferences to work on the Shabbos. So I've never had any experience in this area at all. So the Shabbos that I spoke there, so they had a session for about an hour or so. They were shooting questions, question and answer period. Rabbi, what do you say about this case? Complicated cases, the child doesn't get along with the parents and this, not the other thing. So more than half of the questions I said, I don't know. I don't know what the din is. So they never invited me again. I don't blame them. They need someone who knows how to give a straight answer. Yes, no, you got to do it like this, right? So I remember after I spoke, more than half the questions, I said, I don't know what the din is in that case, whether keep it up, takes precedence over this, over that. So afterwards, there was a woman who apparently was sitting next to my wife. So afterwards, she comes over and she says to me, the first time I heard a rabbi speak in public and say so many times, I don't know. So she tells me she used to be married to a rabbi, and her husband knew everything. and there was never any discussion about anything. Whenever any issue came up, he carried the pasuk and the Maamar Chazal and the Shulchan Aruch, and that was it. No room for discussion. So that's why she had to get divorced. That was the ruination of her marriage. You can't. That's a violation of covet. Even if the husband is God's gift to the world. Maybe he is. I don't know. And even if the husband knows all the answers, it's like the child who knows the answer and the parents don't know. There's a din of kibbut av that you're not allowed to bop the parents over the head and say, this is the din and you're in violation of the din. The spouse who is more intelligent than the other spouse, the one with the brains in the outfit, has to treat the less intelligent or the less learned with respect and dignity and explain and win them over to explain why that's the more correct way. If one is going to act like a dictator and say that that's the din and that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch, so that's not a way to speak respectfully to one's spouse. The Radinim, if a person is in violation of mitzvahs, so then the Beis Din has sometimes an obligation to beat up the person, to force the person to do the mitzvahs. So sometimes then there's no Beis Din available. So the Gemara says, Nasis Yodek Shliach Beis Din. We say, whoever happens to be there, Obedin Ish Dinel and Apshei, whenever someone is in violation of a mitzvah, whoever is present has the status of a Shliach Beis Din. So sometimes, if the husband knows his rights and privileges, the husband knows the dinim, sometimes the husband does know. If the husband knows the dinim, so sometimes if it's clear to him that the wife is an outright violation of her obligations, so the Rambam says that he should go to Bezin, and the Bezin will force the wife to wash the dishes, diaper the babies, whatever, within reason. Everything has to be within the Bezin. Has to determine, is it reasonable or not? Maybe the whole marriage setup is unreasonable. But if the Bezin will determine that it's reasonable for the wife to wash the dishes and so on, and she refuses to, so sometimes the Bezin will give her an option. Either she does it, or they're going to get divorced, and she refuses to get divorced. So they'll force her to wash the dishes and so on. But sometimes, in rare cases, the Rambam says, if there's no bezna around to take care of it, so then we have the din that the, whoever happens to be there, so sometimes the husband is there, has the right to hit the wife. It's not a smart idea. He's not going to, he may win this fight, but he's going to lose the marriage. Ultimately, may destroy the marriage. If the husband thinks that it may help, so in rare cases, the Rambam says that he can hit his wife. It's not going to work. Caution, it's not going to work. The Rambam understood from a... Are there any obligations towards step-ins? The Talmud tells us that the mitzvah, the actual mitzvah of Kibbud Av, does not apply, but it's understood that one, we have a general mitzvah to demonstrate hakoras ha-tayv, to demonstrate appreciation towards someone who does any type for me, let alone if certainly if they raised me, or even if they didn't raise me. Some it's my mother's husband, or it's my stepfather, my mother's husband, or my stepmother, my father's wife. So the Gemara says, as long as the parent is alive and this person, let's say, my mother passed away, my father's alive, so let's say my father should remarry. So then there would be a biblical obligation to show respect to the step-parent. After your biological parent dies, then there's no obligation to show respect towards the step-parent. Unless the step-parent raised you and took care of you. So then there's an obligation. Not if I parents had to, it's not the next door neighbor. You have to be nice to the next door neighbor if they were very kind to you. But strictly speaking, the mitzvah of Kibbud Av doesn't apply to, let's say, to adopted parents. To a step-parent, as long as my parent is alive, so then the Talmud says there is an obligation. And after the parent no longer is alive, then no. The Talmud understands this is a way to show respect to my father, that I have to show respect to his wife, so indirectly this is considered respect to the father. Yeah. Yeah, but after the biological parent dies and then the step parent is remains alive, then there's no obligation. The Talmud says when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi passed away, the one who edited the Mishnah, he left instructions that the children should be hizoru b'kvod imchem, that they should be mindful of their mother, that they should respect her. The Talmud says, what kind of a tzavo is that? Aseres adibris. It says kaberes avichu esi necho. Why did he have to write aseres adibris? Mara says, no, their mother had passed away, and he had remarried. So as long as he was alive, it didn't require that they should show respect for the step-parent, because that's an indirect way of showing respect to him. But after he dies, they're not obligated anymore. So he wrote in his tzavo, his order before him, and they should still continue to show respect towards the step-parent even after he dies. He wanted out of Kibbud Av, they should still continue it even after he's no longer alive. What you usually do is you have to speak to his rabbi, then he should try to hold drushes on the topic or speak to him about it, because you're going to make an open confrontation, so then it'll just disintegrate further. It'll ruin the situation even worse than it was before. Got to speak to a psychologist to figure that out. Yeah. If she knows the dinim. Same thing. The Rambam adds on another wrinkle with respect to the kavod that the wife has for the husband. The wife has to show kavod abrius to all human beings. Lo yitama, kavachamer from kavod amesim, certainly there's kavod achayim. And not all people are created equal, so the covet for spouses is more than the covet for other people. So that's one aspect of the covet. Then the wife has to be supportive of the husband's business endeavors. She has to help him out. But more than that, the Rambam understands from the Gemara that the wife has to have an attitude to look up to her husband like she would be to have respect for her husband, as if he were a very important person. Where did the Rambam get this from? The Gemara recommends that when a boy is looking for a shidduch, he should marry a girl from a lower level of society. He's going to marry a girl whose father's the chief rabbi, so she's only going to respect her father. She's never going to respect him, so she will not look up to him. So the Gemara recommends nechoz dargo unesivitzu. You should always go down one madrega lower, at least one madrega lower, and marry a girl from the male. The girl will look up to you. The Gemara has also a statement which is quoted in Shulchan Aruch: Ezel ha'ishuk sheira kol she'ezer etzayim b'ayla. Who is considered a wonderful wife if she's obedient to the husband? What do you mean obedient? Where does that come from? Who states that the wife is mukhif to be obedient, to listen to the husband? The Gemara tells, and what it means is, I mean, if the husband has a good idea and the wife thinks that it's also a good idea, so she's not being obedient to the husband, it's not etzayim b'ayla, that's etzayim also, if he convinces her. Means that she thinks that he's crazy. She doesn't agree. And still the Gemara says, even though it's only with same bila, it's the wish of the husband, so the Gemara says, if the wife will listen to the wish of the husband, so this will be, she's an ishik sheva, even if it doesn't make sense. So the Gemara tells a story. My oldest daughter married a boy from Switzerland, very lovely young man. So when they first got married, he didn't speak English too well. My daughter hardly spoke Swiss German either. So at that time, we had a little son who was a little pipsqueak. Now he's already tall and thin. But at that time, he was a little boy, so he wanted to speak at the Shabbat brachah. So he got up and he had to stand up on a chair. And he told over this story. He remembered, I must have told this story once then before he went to sleep. So he told over this story that the Gemara says that there were a husband and a wife who got married from two different parts of Eretz Yisrael. And each one spoke a different dialect of Hebrew. So the wife never understood what the husband wanted. Husband said he wants something for supper, so she always cooked the wrong thing. And she didn't understand what he was saying. She was afraid to ask him. So on one occasion, the husband was so frustrated. He was so upset why the wife doesn't understand him. So he gave his wife a candlestick, and he told his wife she should bang this candlestick on the bova. The word bova means the doorpost, the lintel on top of the doorpost. So the husband was angry, so he said, bang this on the doorpost. She came from that part of it, so she didn't know what the word bava meant. So she took the candlestick, she didn't know where she's supposed to bang it. So as they were talking, a rabbi passed by in the street, his name happened to be Bava Ben Buta. One of the Tanoim, Bava Ben Buta. Oh, so she knows Bava, that's Rabbi Bava. So she took the candlestick, and she bopped the rabbi, went into the street, bopped him over the head. So he said, what was this all about? The rabbi says, she says, my husband, and she spoke in her dialect of Hebrew. My husband said I should bang the thing over the bava. So he understood that the rabbi understood that the wife misunderstood the husband. The husband didn't mean she should bang it. So he meant to bang it on the doorpost for some reason or another. So he said, that's wonderful, young lady. You should be blessed with wonderful children. You're a wonderful wife because you listen to the husband even if it doesn't make any sense. So it doesn't say that one is obligated. It doesn't say you're obligated. It says that that's an ishak shera. We have a medrash that has like that. The medrash, this sounds like a chassidish averku, but this says in a medrash on the opening pasuk in the Zayis HaBracha. It says, Zayis HaBracha sheberach Moshe ishu alakim ez b'nei Yisrael. The following is the blessing that Moshe Rabbeinu gave to the Jewish people, and Moshe Rabbeinu is described as the ishu alakim, a man of God. Pasuk shak, ishu alakim, a man of God. So the Medrash translates the husband of God, Ishu Elokim, like Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi. Ishu Elokim, as if the Shechina, as if the Rabbeinu Shalom is the wife, and Moshe Rabbeinu is the husband. Whatever the husband says, the wife has to listen. So Moshe Rabbeinu gave a bracha, said the Shechina is going to have to listen, because the Rabbeinu Shalom is a good wife, and he's going to listen to what the husband says. Moshe Rabbeinu was the husband. So but it's a Medrash Tamfum. It's printed in all the Midrashim, a Medrash Tamfum. So there is such a concept. So it's considered a recommendation that the wife should be obedient to the husband even if she thinks that it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't mean if the husband is clearly telling the wife to do an avera, to bop someone over the head, that you're not allowed to listen to him. But it means if the husband makes a recommendation, the wife disagrees, So they should discuss it in a decent fashion. And if she can't win out, she can't convince him otherwise, so the Gemara recommends that the wife should go along with the husband. The Gemara says that some of the rabbis, when they got married, they realized that a marriage is sometimes going to be a dispute and it's going to be a stalemate. So the husband will insist one way, the wife insists another way. So which route are you going to take? So the Gemara says that some of the rabbis made a deal with their wives when they first got married that if they'll debate something out in a kavodik fashion, a reasonable, a respectful fashion, and then it'll still be a stalemate in the end. So they made up in advance that in any issues of religion, which yeshiva to send the children, or something like that, which shul to daven in, the husband should have the final say. That's on the assumption that the husband is more learned than the wife. If we live in a generation, half the time the wife is more learned than the husband. Sometimes the husband's baal teshuva doesn't know what's going on. The wife has traditions from the grandparents and great-grandparents all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So in the days of the Gemara, this was one recommendation, that they would make up any mili d'shmaya, any religious issues, the husband should have the final say. And any mili d'alma, any worldly matters, what kind of furniture to buy, what kind of drapes to buy, what kind of clothing to buy, that the wife should have the final say. They say that Rabbi Saul Salanter once made a comment after many years of marriage. He said when he first got married, he made such an agreement with his wife, and he was married for 40 years. And surprise of surprise, no mili d'alma ever came up. Everything was mili d'shmaya, and he always had the final say. It's possible. They say that in recent years, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, when his wife passed away, so he delivered a eulogy. So he said that usually the minhag is, the custom is, that when someone dies, the one who delivers a eulogy asks mechila from the one who died, in case we weren't careful. We were disrespectful. So he said in public that he's not going to ask mechila of his wife. He always showed respect for his wife. And he told people in public, I think not in the Hesped, that he said publicly in the Hesped. And he told people privately that when he got married in the Yichud room, he was very bright. He was a very promising star when he was single. A very big tamchach, and that's why they grabbed him. So he knew that he was very sharp. So he said he told his wife in the Yichud room, whenever there's going to be a dispute, you're right. You always win. He says, because I'm so sharp, and I'm always going to explain why I'm right. I am ready giving you now. You're always right. So that was how he maintained the Shalom Bayis. And any dispute, he always gave in to his wife. Moshe Rabbeinu is described Yisrael Elohim.
What about when Moshe says, Avraham,
the Rabbeinu Shalom tells Avraham Avinu, your wife is greater in prophecy than you are. So you have to listen to her. No, but the Rabbanu Shalom tells him that your wife has nevuah. She's greater in prophecy.
So it only applies to
Sarah? Yeah.
Oh, so we learn nothing from that for the following.
That's what the Medrash says, that she was greater in prophecy than her husband. Yeah.
So why does one by Moshe Rabbeinu follow the man, but by Sarah and Mom, he only learns Sarah?
Good question.
Okay.
I don't know. So there you go. Very good question. A significant aspect in marriage is the issue of tznius. The Mishnah says that the husband always pays ksuba in any case of a divorce unless you can ascertain that the wife is really at fault. So what is an instance where the wife is at fault? So the Mishnah has one example. If when they got married it was understood the wife was going to cover her hair, and then later on she decides she's not going to cover her hair. We live in a generation, a lot of people get married, they're not interested that the first 10 years, the first 20 years, the husband never asked his wife to cover hair. All of a sudden, the husband gets all crazy about that. You know what I mean? And more religious observers, he's holding by divorcing his wife because she's not covering her hair. What do you mean? We got married. It was understood I'm not going to cover my hair. You can't decide later on. You can't change the rules of the game in the middle. But in the days of the Tanaim, when it was understood that she's going to cover her hair, and then later on she decides she doesn't want to, so that's considered grounds for divorce. Or the Mishnah has, if the wife walks out in public indecently exposed, she's not properly dressed. Or if she speaks about personal matters in public, so this is an impropriety, and we consider this as ruinous of the marriage. Tznius doesn't only refer to modesty and dress, it refers to maintaining privacy on private affairs. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is himself a kel mistater. The Novi Yeshai describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a kel mistater, God who hides. He does, in fact, he does such a good job of hiding, there's so many who don't even know that he's there. So many people who don't believe that that there's anybody there on the other side of the fence. But we believe he's there and he's hiding. And he created all of us, B'Tselem Elokim, and he expects us also to maintain private lives. He wants us to lead as much private life as possible. Sometimes we have no choice, we have to do things in public. But in principle, we want to have private lives. So the Mishnah says that privacy is important in dress, privacy is important in speech, modesty, and in actions, and in attitudes. Everything should be done in a tzniyazdika fashion to maintain privacy. So the Mishnah considers, like in Shulchan Aruch, there's a minhag that a woman doesn't advertise when she's going to mikvah. So it's no one's business. In the days of the Talmud, when a person, the women would wear different dresses when they would be tameos, when they would be tahoris, because it was relevant. Anything they would touch would become tameh. The food would become tameh. The tables would become tameh. The plates would become tameh. They'd shake hands with someone. The other person would become tameh. So it was everybody had to know. Little girls would go to mikvah, so single people would go to mikvah. Everybody had to go to mikvah when they were tameh in order to become tahor, in order that the truma should become tameh. But b'zman hazeh, that the whole relevance of the mikvah is only with respect to married people. So the Shulchan Aruch records a minig that the women don't discuss it in public, they don't advertise it. Sometimes you have Bali Tshuva who are not familiar with this issue, so they think that it's a big mitzvah to advertise, like they want to advertise that they're keeping all the mitzvahs, they want to advertise that they're going to the mikveh, or they're not going to the mikveh, or whatever the case happens to be. But in Shulchan Aruch, this is considered also one of the inyanim of tzniyus. To lead as private a life as possible, and the Mishnah considers a wife who's in violation. Again, whenever the couple gets married, the husband has to pay the ksuba. So the Mishnah doesn't have to say what's considered improper on the side of the husband. He doesn't have to do anything that's improper. Then they get divorced, so he pays ksuba, period. He doesn't have to be at fault, even if it's not at fault. The Mishnah only lists in the one direction which rare cases do we say that the husband doesn't have to pay ksuba, only if the wife is at fault. So one of the instances that appears in the Mishnah is if the wife acts in a highly improper fashion with respect to tzniyus. So she's talking about their marital relations in public, or she's talking, or she walks in public not properly dressed, and so on. The Torah has an institution of divorce. Sometimes the Rabbanim recommend that couple should get divorced. I remember there was one instance in the yeshiva where there was a terrible marriage that was ridiculous from day number one. The boy was 25 years older than the girl. He was a Sephardi and she was an Ashkenazi. Yeah, and she was very learned and he knew nothing. He was a Baal Tshuva. So the whole thing didn't make any sense. She wanted to sacrifice her life like Eishes Rabbi Akiva, that her husband should become a learned person. The whole thing was ridiculous anyway until they finally got together. I remember on that occasion Rabbi Lifshitz was involved a little bit, and he said he has a tradition from his father-in-law that sometimes you drink l'chaim when a couple gets divorced. Sometimes a mitzvah to get divorced. Okay. So it's not when couples go to the Rabbonim when they have marital problems, the Rabbonim should not always insist that they should remain together. Sometimes it's terrible that they should remain together. Sometimes they will recommend that they should get divorced. If it seems to be reasonable that they should patch everything up, often it is reasonable, it's just silly issues that they're fighting about. And each one only looks from his perspective and they don't realize that their requests are unreasonable. But if it's taka, if the marriage is ridiculous, then the Rabbanim will recommend that they should get divorced, and it's a mitzvah. The Rishonim discuss why no bracha is recited. Sometimes it's. So many Rishonim say the reason why a blessing is not recited when you give a get, it's because most of the time, more than 50% of the time, they're doing an aveira in getting divorced. But that's why, that's what the Avodah Zarah writes. The Avodah Zarah has a long essay in the beginning of the Sefer, which mitzvahs require a bracha and which not, and when do you say Allah, when do you say lif? Allah tilas adayim or likra sahalim. So he speaks about a get. So he says, since most of the time the get is really the iser, and the Gemara says that it's a tragedy, and the Mizbeach is crying when people get divorced, So since most of the time it's not there, so that's why they never instituted a bracha. But sometimes it is a mitzvah. The Torah has a parsha of get, and sometimes it is a mitzvah. Yeah.
In the situation
depends what was understood at the time that they got married. If the wife lives in such a society and she thought she's going to lead a life like everybody, she's going to dress like all the women in her community. So if the husband wanted her super duper extra special, a shaper with a hat on top of it and long dresses down there, he should have said so. He never said a word. So she said, that's not right. So he's imposing his religious standards, even if he's right according to the din. But she didn't think that that was, she didn't think that that's what she's getting herself into. So you can't say that it's her fault.
And the reverse also, they had high standards and then she decided that she wanted to lower her standards, but it's not street food. It's just not the same high standards that she had originally. Would that still be her?
I think so. So then they got married on that understanding that it's going to be on the higher standard. And she doesn't want to live up to her half of the deal. So then that would be considered that he's right. And insisting on the higher standards. Very often the friction in marriage is due to the fact that the people don't realize that they're a dinim, that there are obligations over here. If the people would just, there are several svarim in English and in Hebrew on the topic, if people would just look through the svarim and see what the obligations are, there are reciprocal obligations in marriage. All of the obligations are reciprocal. The husband has obligations towards the wife and the wife has obligations towards the husband. Monetary, physical, and service, and covenant, and so on and so forth. So, much of the problem would be solved, much of the issues of Shalom Bayis would be resolved if the people would just realize that they're in the wrong. The halacha says that the other spouse is right. You want to say about the spending money? They should discuss it with each other. They have. I have no problems. My wife makes out all the checks. I don't care. Let her spend whatever she wants. If other people have an issue, so let them discuss it amongst themselves, in a kavodika fashion, in a respectful fashion, and then you have to have a hachro. So if they can't come to hachro among themselves, so they'll ask a third party. A third party is usually very clear who has the more reasonable taina. Usually it's very simple. Usually it's one is very clear that this is the more reasonable, and the other one is absolutely unreasonable. But reviewing the dinim is often very helpful. Like in Lashon Hara, everybody violates Lashon Hara, they don't review the dinim. If you review the laws of Lashon Hara, so you'll be able to be nizer more. So there are laws of marital obligations. So when people review those dinim, that will help a lot. By the way, just another point, people have the attitude that the prohibition of Lashon Hara means you're not allowed to tell Lashon Hara about someone else. You're not allowed to tell someone else Lashon Hara. But when I come home and I tell my wife all the Lashon Hara that happened in the course of the day, Ishtek Gufoy. That's not Lashon Hara. I'm just reviewing them to myself. I'm so close to my wife. Or to tell Lashon Hara about a spouse. So a lot of people feel like they talk on the telephone, they talk all kinds of things about their spouse. So that's not permissible to Chofetz Chaim, right? It's not permissible to talk Lashon Hara to one spouse, nor is it permissible to talk Lashon Hara to a stranger about one spouse. The spouse is not ishta kigufoy or about ishta with respect to Lashon Hara. In fact, if you didn't, we say kraven. Anyone who my wife's cousin is plus latest to me also. Ishta kigufoy is a din in kraven. That's it. But it's not a din that is treated like one person. That there's no prohibition of ainoa of hurting their feelings. Of course, it's a different person. There's a din of ainoa zvorm. There's a din of chayvah b'chaber. There's a din of Lashon Hara and so on. Okay. Agutavach.
Sorry about this week. My brother got Thursday night, so we have a client now.
Oh, very nice.
Good job.
I don't know if I got the whole thing.
What is it?
I had some problems.